Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Friday, April the 15th. Welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, how authentic is the latest Boko Haram video? Was it really filmed as late as December the 25th, 2015?
I just somehow have my doubts about the timing because there's really no way to verify that. And the girls are really, they're looking really good.
And in South Africa, a controversial prisoner could be about to receive parole.
If Januzwa loses a model prisoner, then our country is in danger. He is unrepentant, unremorseful. He does not demonstrate any understanding of the enormity of the crime he committed.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Nigeria has been marking the second anniversary of the abduction of almost 300 girls from a school in Chibok. 219 girls are still missing, but Nigerians were given new hope that they could be found alive when CNN showed 15 of them dressed in black robes and identifying themselves. Meanwhile, members of the Bring Back Our Girls group have marched on the villa of President Muhammadu Buhari in protest at the government's inability to secure the girls' release. From the capital Abuja, Uwais Abubakar Idris reports.
When shall we stop? When shall we stop?
It is a solemn moment for the members of the Bring Back Our Girls campaigners, especially parents of the girls who held protest to mark 2 years since their daughters were abducted by Boko Haram. Aisha Yusufu is the chairman of the strategic team of the campaigners. She explains the significance of their protest.
Today it's a really sad day. It's a heartbreaking day. It's a heart-wrenching day. It's a day that an unimaginable day, because nobody would have imagined that 219 girls would be left in captivity with terrorists for 2 whole years. Today is exactly 731 days that the Chibok girls were abducted. And it's so sad that now we are still talking about the rescue of the Chibok girls rather than talking about the reintegration, reuniting them with the family. They are moving on with their lives. So today is quite a painful day, but it's still a day of renewal, of that hope that we've always had.
Their protest march to the presidential villa was met with angry security men who blocked them from getting in. No government official was in the vicinity, a situation which Obi Ezekwesili calls it unacceptable. The appearance of a video released by Boko Haram showing 15 out of the 219 abducted girls raises hope for Esther Yakubu, whose daughter is still in captivity.
I'm sad internally, but inside me, I'm rejoicing because I have that hope that they are alive. And now the world have seen that they are alive. And now they have shown the second video. I have that hope they are still alive.
Have you seen your daughter?
She's not among them, but I recognize some among them. And I want the government to please and please, because of God, not because of us, to please rescue our girls.
But how authentic is this video, and what is the government doing about it? Mr. Lai Mohammed is the Nigeria's Minister of Information and Culture.
When we are studying this, sometimes in July last year, we received a similar video. But when we tried to meet with those who brought us the video and who claimed to represent the Boko Haram leadership, after many weeks of engagement, you find that the whole thing was a hoax, and that is why we are also being very cautious in respect of this particular video.
Although there is no news on the whereabouts of the girls, to Maureen Kabrook, a member of the campaigners, there is no turning back.
No matter the intimidation, no matter the oppression, we are built for this. For as long as our Chibok girls are still in captivity, We'll carry on, we'll press on with its demands. If it requires us coming to set camps here, we will do so.
It is clear that the Nigerian government is getting into a more difficult situation on the issue of the Chibok girls, as Nigerians await the controversies surrounding this complicated issue.
Wes Abubakar Idris in Abuja. Let's get some expert opinion now on that video which surfaced on CNN on Thursday and was purportedly recorded on December the 25th, 2015. Crispin Mwahideu has been talking to Mauzi Segun, a researcher with Human Rights Watch in Nigeria. What was her first reaction on seeing the video?
I think that the 15 girls who were shown in that video were deliberately chosen. And then I think the second thing that occurred to me was a little bit of confusion about the dates. If you look at that video and compare it with the first video released by Boko Haram after the girls were abducted, this was in May 2014. It looks pretty similar, the clothing. And, you know, they looked really healthy. And I'm wondering, I mean, considering the environment that we know that Boko Haram has been living in the bush, moving from place to place, how they have been able to keep the girls so healthy. But I guess part of it was also really relief that at least we know that this number of girls might be alive at this time.
So what you're saying is that you actually doubt whether what we saw is really what is actually true.
I think that Boko Haram might have played on the timing of that video. I think one of the girls mentioned 25th of December, which means that it was just a couple of months ago. Somehow, I wish there was anything else that could have indicated the date in the video itself, not the coding on the video.
Now, some of the girls who escaped from Boko Haram have reportedly become mothers or are expecting. More than 200 are still in captivity. What state of mind do you imagine them to be right now?
I think to clarify, none of the Chibok school girls who escaped are pregnant. None of them have had children. But other women and other girls who have escaped from Boko Haram abduction have been found pregnant. And, you know, from just interviewing some of those women and girls, it is clear that the kind of treatment that they got while they were with Boko Haram, many of them, because they were Christians, they were forced to convert to Islam. Many were forced into marriages with their captors.
And there has been a lot of criticism by parents of these girls and the Bring Back Our Girls activists that the Nigerian government is simply not doing enough to rescue these girls. Do you also share the same sentiments?
What I would consider as a failure from the government is not engaging enough. It does appear, for example, with the release of this video, that the government has been aware of the video but didn't share it with the parents. And it also appears that there was a demand for ransom by Boko Haram, which means that some form of engagement was going on with Boko Haram by the government, and none of this was made known to the parents of the girls.
You mentioned just briefly there about the negotiations that could be going on. Do you think that the government should agree to Boko Haram's previous demands of swapping prisoners for the girls?
Really, it's up to the government to weigh their options. But for us, one of the key recommendations and tenets of justice is that, those who commit crimes and human rights abuses must be held accountable.
Mauzi Segun, researcher with Human Rights Watch in Nigeria.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
A court in South Africa has cleared the way for the release of a Polish immigrant who was jailed for killing a prominent figure in the anti-apartheid movement. Janusz Wolus had been sentenced to life for the assassination of Chris Arne, a top ANC leader, in 1993. Wolus was granted parole in March after nearly 23 years in jail, but the Justice Minister lodged an appeal against the decision. That appeal has now been dismissed by a court in Pretoria. Subri Govender has the story, beginning with the ruling by Judge Nicolie Nieuwen Eetsen.
The first respondent's application for leave to appeal is dismissed. 2. The first respondent ordered to pay the cost of the application, which costs include the cost of 2 counsel.
23 years after the murder of freedom and struggle stalwart Chris Arne, the way has been paved for Janusz Wolus, the Polish immigrant who pulled the trigger, to be released on parole. Alex Mashile, spokesperson for the South African Communist Party, reacted to the High Court judge's decision.
If Januzwa loses a model prisoner, then our country is in danger. He is unrepentant, unremorseful. He does not demonstrate any understanding of the enormity of the crime he committed. All the patchwork he was doing in order to be seen to be showing remorse was simply to qualify for the process of parole and nothing else.
When Ani was shot dead on April 10, 1993, he was destined to play a major role in the political negotiations and in the subsequent government set up by Nelson Mandela. He was leader of the South African Communist Party and a top leader of the ANC. At the time, people were outraged by the murder, but this anger and fury mellowed after Ani's killers were sentenced to death. All the role players, including Nelson Mandela, were very well aware that if the killers had not been sentenced to death, this would have caused wide-scale political chaos and could have led to a race war. Under South Africa's new democratic laws, the death sentences for Wallace and his co-accused, Clive Darby Lewis, were, however, turned into life imprisonment. Yet, people accepted this decision. The Minister of Justice, Michael Masuta, who had appealed the move to now let Wallace out on parole, said that his department would not only appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal, but also to the Constitutional Court. He said Wallace was not ready for parole.
Parole is not an automatic right. If you are sentenced to life, you are indeed sentenced to life. Parole simply means continuing to serve your sentence outside of a correctional facility, subject to certain conditions. And to enjoy that privilege, you've got to earn it.
Limpo Hani, the widow of Chris Hani, was present in court. She said she fully supported the minister's decision to take the matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal. She condemned the judge's decision and said she had not been told the truth by the killers of her husband.
We have been through all the courts. We have gone to TRC. I even sent somebody while I was in parliament to ask these guys to tell me the truth. And at that time, for now, I withhold the name of the person I asked. I even said to them, if you tell the truth, I will appeal to the South African government to release you. Do you want to know what the answer was? They told me to go to hell. So we are dealing here with people who have no interest in telling the truth. They just want to get parole.
The Yanis Wallace parole case will take another turn on the 20th of April when his attorneys will lodge an application for his immediate parole as ordered by the Pretoria High Court early last month.
Sobri Govender reporting.
Human rights.
And human rights this week takes us to Eritrea. Every month, as many as 5,000 Eritreans flee their country, according to figures released by the United Nations. One reason young men leave is to escape compulsory military service, which can be extended indefinitely under the country's authoritarian regime. Oliver Rama has just been to Eritrea after being granted rare press accreditation to visit the country. His report has been adapted for Africa Link by Jane Nyingi.
We are in the village of Tokombia, 200 kilometres from the capital, Asmara. It consists of a few mud huts in the scorching sun, and the Ethiopian border is not far away. Tesfalem Andom is the village elder.
It is quiet along the border. Not much happens. We don't want any trouble with the Ethiopians.
Tesfalem Andom is a member of the ruling party. The People's Front for Democracy and Justice, PFDJ, is the only party in Eritrea, and it is not democratic. The PFDJ has ruled the country since it gained independence from Ethiopia in 1993. Eritrea has no constitution, no press freedom. The country's notoriety stems largely from its national service. That is 18 months of compulsory military service for young men, which can be extended for years. National service is the main reason why young Eritreans flee their country. But when asked about it, Tesfalem Andom replies evasively.
It's normal for people to come and go. They go in groups to Ethiopia only to discover that life isn't easy in refugee camps.
Thousands leave Eritrea every month, heading either for Ethiopia or Sudan. It can be a risky undertaking because of tension caused by a border dispute between Ethiopia and Eritrea. In Eritrea, criticism of the government or state can land you in prison without trial and without any knowledge of how long you'll spend behind bars. We're in a car talking to John. That's not his proper name, and we are deliberately distorting his voice. John deals in foreign currency on the black market. That is illegal. If he were to be caught, he would end up in jail.
I mean, I'm not proud of doing some illegal things. I would prefer to do some things which are legal, but I have to live, I have to sustain my life also.
The cost of living in Eritrea is very high and wages are low. The frustration this causes and the fear of the state can be felt wherever you go. But the ruling elites insist the international community doesn't understand Eritrea, or more specifically, its national service. Yemane Gebreb is an advisor to the president, Isaias Afewerki.
People who don't know what Eritrea is, where Eritrea is, first thing they ask you is national service. I say, how can national service in a very small country in this world become a topic of global conversation?
Peter Schwittol runs a small German aid organization dedicated to improving the healthcare infrastructure in Eritrea. Despite all his idealism, the German medical practitioner admits that he's forced to face up to the reality of life in Eritrea. That includes the exodus of the young and the skilled.
It
can be very hard when, after having trained up a surgeon or a pediatrician, you suddenly discover that person is no longer there. It's a huge loss because there are so few trained medical personnel in the country.
And that report was written by Oliver Rammer. People online in Zimbabwe are worried that freedom of expression could be severely curtailed if the government goes ahead with plans for strict monitoring of the internet and social media platforms. President Robert Mugabe has already hinted at the existence of such plans to reduce what he calls abuse of technology by Zimbabweans. Privilege Mushaniri has sent us this report from Harare.
Are you serious?
Yeah, but that's no, we can't have that. It's the internet.
Young people are busy working at a core creative hub in Harare. I visited this place and asked about implications of internet censorship on their work.
We are going on the internet and getting our minds stimulated, and now he's saying that he wants to put measures. Does he want us to be like North Korea? No ways.
It's not going to affect me much because it's almost impossible to censor the internet. This is not something they can do. The technology doesn't allow you to block everything. Even in China, there are ways to get around the Great Firewall.
These are real concerns from these young web users. Upon his return from a 5-day state visit to Japan, President Mugabe told his party supporters that his government is considering going the Chinese way to monitor the internet. His reasons are abuse and insults.
There is a lot of filth in social media. There are a lot of serious insults peddled in there, a lot of abuses. Some are now using it in negative ways. China set up security measures, and we will soon look into how they are administering it so that the abuses and insults can be reduced.
Internet and social media has become a post for free expression in a country that has restrictive media laws. There are fears that the government may increase scrutiny on content shared by citizens ahead of elections expected in 2018. Harare-based blogger Munyaradzi Dodo is scared but says young people shall find ways to circumvent any restrictions.
For people like us, we're going to be scared to write certain things. We're going to have people who are going to start finding ways around that firewall, and it's going to give rise to a lot of digital rebels, I guess, who will now start to fight this type of system.
There is a growing trend of African governments shutting down internet to silence citizens during election time, the latest example being Congo-Brazzaville. Digital security trainer Natasha Musonza says censoring internet is a violation of people's rights.
This promise of an internet censorship is not only unfair, I think it's also, it goes against the entire fabric of democracy that Zimbabwe purports to be at this point.
Zimbabwe has laws that incriminate people who are judged to be insulting the president. President Mugabe is a favorite target of many for social media ridicule. The Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights reported last month that up to 150 Zimbabweans have been arrested since 2010 for alleged Mugabe insults, and these include those made via WhatsApp and Facebook.
Privilege Mushaniri reporting from Harare.
Your C.
And now your chance to tell us what you think of the stories we've been covering here on Africa Link over the past week. We join Eunice Wanjuru and Temi Omaladi.
We begin in Nigeria, which has been hit by one of the worst fuel shortages this year. We reported on how motorists spent hours in queues at petrol stations only to be told that oil has run out. Once considered Africa's largest oil producer, Nigeria is now forced to import oil. Ironic as it may sound, the scarcity of oil is having an impact on other economic sectors.
Aliyu Mohammed Al-Kassim from Yobe State in Nigeria commented and said, "Oil has become both a blessing and a curse upon the country. He says it's a blessing because they were able to generate revenue meeting the domestic needs of the people, and a curse because Nigeria themselves do not realize the potential of oil and end up vandalizing the pipelines, which is also a curse of the fuel scarcity."
And Aliyu also went on to say that fuel scarcity became an issue right after the former president, Goodluck Jonathan, left office. He said that the Buhari-led administration has been slow in handling the issue of fuel scarcity.
We also received a comment on the same from Usman bin Afan Damanturu from Northern Nigeria. He's surprised that the largest oil-producing country in Africa could be experiencing fuel scarcity. He's wondering where the oil being extracted in the country goes to.
He adds that President Buhari has to find a solution for the problem and says, I quote, "We want him to do something quick so that this problem may end."
In our program last week, we covered the visit of Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta to Germany. DW was able to do an exclusive interview with him. Kenyatta said that the International Criminal Court needed to be reformed and that Kenya was ready to leave the ICC if the necessary required reforms were not met.
The interview was also posted on our Facebook page and it got a lot of comments. John Sam wrote, "Wondering why African leaders rejected the ICC, saying that the court does not provide equal treatment, whereas most of them are not the choice of the majority."
Kiken Makke has a similar thought. He says, "Let the people decide and there will be no need of the ICC, that the voting system and the process should be fair."
Kenyatta also received some praise from some of our listeners. Josephine Muringo wrote, "Besides being a good orator, President Uhuru Kenyatta is a well-informed person."
Last but not least, we reported on the Chibok girls who were abducted from their school 2 years ago, on which 219 of them are still missing. The parents of these girls are still traumatized. There's hope and frustration at the same time.
And John Joseph commented by asking Boko Haram to try and have peace talks with the Nigerian government to bring harmony to the country. That's all we had for this week's Your Say.
And as the music dies away, we heard Eunice Wanjiru and Temi Omaladi. Very many thanks. And Your Say will, of course, be back at the same time next week. And if you'd like to contribute to Your Say, then the address to write to is Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. You can, of course, send an email to feedback.africa@dw.com or an SMS to country code 49 160 957 59510. A reminder of our main stories before we leave you. The Bring Back Our Girls group has marked the second anniversary of the Chibok kidnappings with a march on President Buhari's villa in Abuja. A court in South Africa has cleared the way for the release on parole of a man imprisoned for the murder of a top ANC leader in 1993. We've also been hearing about rights abuses in Eritrea and fears of internet censorship in Zimbabwe. And then we come to the end of another week here on Africa Link. Jane Ayeko will be here on Monday. Do join her if you can. Have a pleasant weekend. Until the next time, this is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.